So welcome everyone to the Jewish Community Center, our next installment of our Coffee Cake and Learning. And today we're doing the Book of Ruth, The Kindness of Strangers. So before we begin, let's just discuss the concept of chesed. It's a good word. Kindness. Chesed. We say that the world was built upon kindness. And when we speak of kindness, we need to understand the unique opportunity that each of us has in this world to participate in this foundational kindness decree that was a foundational building block for our world. But we need to understand a little more about the nature of God's kindness to us. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, every time we try to attribute a human personality trait to God, it's a little iffy, right? There's a very big word, which I'll probably butcher as I say the word to you. It's called anthropomorphizing. That's the real word. And I think I got it correct, but good luck on the Scrabble or Bananagram game with that word. I'm not quite sure. I would need a spell check for that one. And essentially, when you anthropomorphize, you say basically, if God was a human being, this would be the attribute that we give to God for that type of behavior. But because God is unknowable and not a human being, we sense certain midot, certain attributes that God behaves in a certain hanhaga, a certain way with the human beings. And therefore we say, oh, well, if God was a human, this would be kindness. If God was a human, this would be justice. Whatever we say. Now, knowing that God is not human and he's unknowable means that it's simply a projection. We're projecting that if God was a human being, this clearly God is not subject. Hashem is not subject to human desires, to human whims, to human needs, and to human sensibilities. So I'll give you an example. So we say that God was angry. God was angry. God doesn't get angry. He's not a human being. He's not petty. He's not going to say, well, you broke one of the rules of the Torah, of the Bible, and I'm going to get angry. That's ridiculous. God has multiple panim. He presents a face, quote unquote. Again, please don't take that literally. It's metaphorical. He has panim. He has faces. So there's a countenance. That's the way we like to translate that word. God projects a countenance. So one of the issues we have as humans is we say, well, wait a minute, if God is angry with the Jewish people, and he got angry just a few times there in the Torah, in the Bible, you know, God can, in a second, change his countenance. Now, you and I can't do that. Good luck trying to do that yourself. If only we had that ability in a moment of anger, in a moment of frustration, where we could just snap our fingers and go, okay, new face, new countenance. But God obviously can do this. So therefore, it's a projection from a human to God. So that, let's back up now. What does that mean for kindness? God could have created a world sans the need for any human intervention. Think about it for a moment. There are actual creations of God. They're not very fancy creations of God, that produce their own food, for example. And therefore they have no need to rely on external forces to help. They're sort of like a little mini nuclear power plant, right? They produce their own energy. They're not fanciful creatures, okay? So again, it's off the class's topic today, but it's a fascinating idea. So what if Hashem had created every creation independent of him? Meaning, he could have hardwired the coding in creation and nature as such that would allow every creature to be independent of him. Why would he want certain dependencies? Okay, so there's a myriad of reasons. A simple reason is he wants a relationship with us, with human beings. If he didn't want a relationship, then he could have given us all a little trust fund somewhere and said, you know, I don't really like you, and I don't want you praying to me or talking to me or communicating with me or showing up at the palace sort of like a muscle, like an analogy to a king who has somebody he really doesn't want to see. So he, you know, writes them off a nice check and a trust fund because he doesn't want to deal with this person, as opposed to the person that he loves and he has endearment for. He specifically wants the person in his proximity that will have to continually come for a check or for a check-in with the king. So if the king loves you, he kind of wants you. He's desirous of you. Hashem loves us and wants us to be part and parcel of the world. He wants us to pray to him. He wants us to have things that are needs. Okay, so again, if Hashem created a world with needs, the point of what I'm saying, and I know it's a little psychological what I've said so far, but it's a very powerful idea. Why would he create a need for us? But also on his side, but as we touched on, but mainly for us. Because if we were not in need of God's attention, think of what the relationship would be like with Hashem. Right? You know the expression, there are no atheists in a foxhole. Every hospital you visit, well, everyone I have visited, share a commonality. They all have some type of little place to pray. Because again, it's crisis mode. You have an atheist or an agnostic or someone who's really not into religion. But when there's a crisis, you got to have a little chapel or some prayer place in the hospital, because that's when we have a crisis and we have a need. We are humans, and we very often ignore God except in times of need and crisis, which is not good. Not good at all. It's not a healthy relationship when you only, it's sort of like the kid who, you know, only calls home when he has something that mom and dad need, you know, to help him with the rent at the apartment or tuition, whatever, he's away at school. Again, not that you shouldn't touch base with mom and dad. That's a good thing. They love it. But it should also be in times of good and times of bad, both equally so. So again, it's a powerful idea. How does this relate to the kindness idea? Because if kindness is a bedrock, a foundation for our world, we're going to learn today that there are good ways of performing kindness that allow a person honor, integrity, independence. And then there are controlling, potentially pernicious, evil ways of doing kindness, where instead of allowing the person who's the beneficiary to feel uplifted and empowered by your kindness, sometimes the kindness could be controlling or makes a person dependent upon the giver. So that's the issue that we're going to deal with. And where does it come from? Believe it or not, it comes from the Torah, from a story that you may or may not be familiar with. The first of the Jewish people was the magnificent Avraham Avinu, Abraham our patriarch. Avraham was defined, you want to take a guess, what was his defining attribute? Kindness. He was the gomel chesed. He was the purveyor of kindness beyond anyone else, perhaps, in world history. Sarah shared the same proclivity for kindness. She was the best. The two of them literally dedicated their lives from beginning to end to try to do for others. We know famously they had their Holiday Inn in Beersheba. Maybe it was a Ritz-Carlton, I don't know, you know, their tents, and it was open on all different sides so that strangers would be able to come and partake in the delicious food and the, I mean, Sarah was a great balabasta, she was a great chef, so the people will come and enjoy Sarah's cooking. You know the famous story with the three angels who come to visit them after Abraham was sick because he had a bris milah, a circumcision at age 99. I do not recommend self-inflicted circumcisions on men at age 99. Yikes. Okay. Be that as it may, the angels come and Sarah and Abraham go crazy getting, you know, the best foods and the best dips, the greatest meal possible. And the rabbis say that it was actually the eve of Passover. Even though you might say, but Rabbi, wait a minute, whoa, whoa. Chronologically, Passover doesn't happen for hundreds of years, and you would be right. But the date was the 14th day of Nisan. That's when Abraham was visited and Sarah by the angels. So it's an amazing thing. It's actually in your Haggadah, if you manage to stay awake long enough, there's a little thing, a little song we do at the end of the Haggadah where it mentions how the angels came to visit Abraham. And then they also went to Sodom, to Sodom and Gomorrah that same night. That might be germane. Let's see if it is. Okay, how does kindness then fit into Abraham's life? Well, it defined who he was, what he was, and how he lived his life, and how Sarah joined in a mission to revolutionize the world. So what would be wrong with that? So I mentioned just a few moments ago that it is entirely possible for someone who is giving to give with strings attached, whether it is subtle or by design. We maybe don't mean to put strings attached to the giving, but we do. And instead of leaving the other person with a feeling of independence and warmth and love, perhaps they take it because they have to, but then that dependent relationship creates this ill will. And you see this, unfortunately, with Abraham's own nephew. There was a young man who grew up into an old man, and his name was Lot, L-O-T, Lot. And Lot was child of Abraham's dead brother. Abraham had a brother named Haran. And Haran did not make it out of Mesopotamia to come to the promised land of Canaan, of Israel. What happened to him? He was immolated, thrown into a fiery oven by King Nimrod, because he didn't really believe in God. He didn't really believe in the faith. And when King Nimrod asked him, which side are you on? Are you on your uncle Abraham's side? Your brother Abraham, he said to Haran, or are you on my side? King Nimrod said, Haran said, And then he finally weighed in on the side of God and Abraham. But by then it was too late. He was thrown into the fiery furnace in Ur Kasdim, and he was burned up. That meant that his children were orphans. So who are his children? Well, Lot was one of the children. But you might be shocked to know, you know who the other child was? Sarah. Sarah. That's our Sarah. Sarah and Lot were brother and sister. Abraham married his niece. I bet you didn't know that one. And totally permissible, even by Torah law. I know it's like, yeah, genetics. But totally okay. They weren't that far apart in years, right? I remember Sarah's like 10 years younger, so it wasn't a crazy age difference. So it was totally okay. And it makes sense, because back then, the family of Abraham had to be very careful to not share too widespread genetics. You're trying to create a gene pool from Abraham and Sarah that would be a positive, righteous gene pool. There were a lot of very decidedly unrighteous people in the world back then. So Abraham and Sarah were married, but Lot was Sarah's brother and nephew of Abraham. And he tagged along. He was sort of adopted, if you will, because of the death of Abraham's brother Haran. Abraham, of course, without question, took Lot in. So things were okay for a while. But then apparently Lot, from his perception, this is critical, what I'm going to share with you is not real. It's not the truth. But it's the reality from the perception of Lot. Lot saw himself, I'm going to use a little superhero analogy, ready? Lot saw himself not as the Cape Crusader Batman, but as the guy in the kind of very garish outfit, Robin. He was always the second guy. Now, if you are a Batman fan, I happen to be a Batman lover, okay? And again, I'm not trying to insult Robin, but he is the worst superhero of all time, in my humble opinion. Okay, first of all, he has no powers, as Batman has no superpower. You know what Batman's superpower was? He was wealthy. I'm joking. And he had the coolest toys, right? And he trained himself in all the martial arts and everything else, and he was broke. But he didn't really have any superpowers as such, but he had money. Okay, he's Bruce Wayne. So who was his sidekick? Robin, right? You remember Robin? He wears like, what is it, yellow?
Like yellow and green.
Yellow and
red
green?
Vest,
right.
Green leotard, yellow cape.
There we are. And you, Lionel. Now, Lionel, would you agree that that Robin was kind of garishly dressed, like he was like a little, yeah, you know what I mean? He was a little outlandish in his dress, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So poor Robin, in our story, Lot saw himself as Robin saw himself. Now, you might say, oh, Rabbi, you're being a little silly. Not really. Bear with me here. In Lot's mind, he wanted to be Abraham. But Abraham was bigger than life. I mean, he's Abraham, he's Avraham Avinu. And he, in the mind only of Lot, he subsumed Lot within the umbrella of his greatness. So there was the Derech Hashem, the way of God through Abraham, and Abraham enveloped his circle of intimate people. Now, Sarah was a full partner in the project of Abraham to bring kindness and yashrut and uprightness and righteousness to the world. They were partners, right? Lot was kind of like the like Robin. He was the superhero Cape Crusaders sidekick, but not really the sidekick. He didn't even get the Robin treatment, you know, unfortunately. I don't think he got to ride on the camel Batmobile. Okay, so he was a little aggrieved. So the greater Abraham got, Lot also benefited. So for example, in the aftermath of them going to Egypt because of a famine, Abraham becomes super wealthy. Lot also becomes super wealthy because he's an adjunct to the gifts that were given to Abraham and Sarah. He protected the identity of Sarah. He's rewarded also with great money. But when the Torah describes Lot, it says, you ready? I'll repeat it. You have to read into the words, which my Rebbe, my teacher, does. Vigam lelot haholeches Avram. Here are the words. This is the Robin thing, okay? Vigam, and also to Lot, who traveled with Abraham. He had great money, great wealth, animals, etc. So he, I believe, in this one word also, it's showing us the Lot mindset. He's the also ran. He's not Abraham, and he's not Sarah, and he's trying to maybe emulate his great teacher, his mentor, his uncle, but he's coming up short, and he feels aggrieved. And again, did this have anything to do with the reality of Abraham and Sarah? I don't think so. So this is not, God forbid, what I'm saying now is not a critique or criticism of Abraham or Sarah. It's just Lot's issue that he had to deal with. He always saw himself as the secondary player in the game of Abraham and Sarah, who were the Nasi Elohim. You know, he was the prince of Hashem. He had, his renown was like literally within every culture that permeated the Middle East. He was the greatest. Even when he goes to buy Sarah's grave, the Hittites don't want to take money from him because they say, wait a minute, you're the Nasi Elohim. You're the representative of God, the prince of God, Abraham. It's free. All right, and one verse later, he asks for $400 million, but that was just a Hittite criminality. But Abraham was bigger than life. But what about Lot? He wanted a little of that self-aggrandizement. So it's really in his mind. He wanted to be bigger, and he wasn't. So what happened? So he started to transgress the Torah law. How did he transgress the Torah law? He, Lot, would allow his shepherds and his people working for him to just graze their animals wherever they wanted to. He had a reason. He had a Torah legitimate mindset. He said, well, wait a minute, Abraham, he thought to himself, God has promised this land to your descendants, yeah? Well, I'm looking around now, and I really don't see any descendants. I see me, like I'm your heir, sort of, to the throne. And since this land of Canaan is eventually going to become Israel, it's all going to be gifted to you by God. Hey, this land is my land at this point in time. Abraham said, wait a minute, look, no. You're wrong. Yes, it's true that this is a gift, but the gift is not ours yet. The Canaanites are still in possession of this land. It won't be until the time of Joshua, after the death of Moses, when we enter the promised land, our great-great-grandchildren, then they will fight for the land and the land will be theirs. But not now. So you have to be very careful. Any food that you want to give your animals must be paid for. Otherwise, it's not yashar. It's not upright. It's not correct. It's a chil Hashem. You're desecrating and undermining my mission because people are going to say we're ganavim, we're gzalim. We're, you know, gezels when you forcibly take something for somebody else. It's thievery. We can't do this. And no one's going to differentiate between you and me. Because Lot apparently had the same type of beard as Abraham. And so in the absence of Abraham, if you saw Lot, you would think, well, that's Abraham. Oh, and Abraham's allowing his animals to steal food and to graze in pasture land that is not his. And people will start to talk against Abraham and Sarah, and it could undermine the whole effect. So first, of course, I'm sure Abraham and Lot had many discussions in the halacha and the Jewish law, but Lot didn't really go for it. No, didn't go for it. So he would refuse to muzzle his sheep and his animals. So finally, Abraham laid down the gambit, the gauntlet. He said, you have two choices here. You can either muzzle the animals, and then you can be with me, and we'll be a team. You'll stay with me forever and ever, and I wish you, please, I love you, and I want you to do this. Or, tragically, I'm sorry, but if you won't do this, you have to go somewhere else. You can't be with me. We cannot be together. You are bringing disgrace to the beginnings of the Jewish people. You can't do this. What do you think Lot did? Bye. He took off. Wow. I mean, think about it. You have a chance to be with Abraham and Sarah, potentially the heir to some part of Abraham and Sarah's legacy, which he really was, but not at all in the way he believed he would be, okay? Because God has a great sense of humor. So Abraham and Sarah stayed in the promised land. And Abraham literally says to him, you know, if I go to the right, you choose the right, I'll go left. You choose north, I'll go south. You have the choice now. Look, and he was perhaps trying to psychologically play with him and say, look, it's not on me, it's on you. So please just select, I stay with you. Right? That's what Abraham and Sarah wanted to hear. Lot, I mean, this is Sarah's brother, right? The legitimate heir to the throne of Abraham and Sarah at that time. How painful was it to poor Abraham that Lot chose to go away? But boy, did he go away. You know where he chose to go? Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah. So, okay, there's going away to a lot. Because, you know, it's the Red Sea and I want to put my feet up on the beach. All right, fine, we get that. You want some nice weather, a nice suntan, you'll go to Miami. There's going to Miami and there's going to Tehran. I mean, think about it. I don't know if you caught this, by the way. The Ayatollah Khomeini today, I can't not mention this, personally thanked all the lunatic, evil people on the campuses who are hating on the Jews. And he said, you guys have formed my resistance. Bravo. You guys are doing God's work. You should learn the Quran now. That's good for them. But I want to thank you for doing this great work on behalf of the Iranian people and all the people who hate the Jews. So bravo. So again, I don't know about you, but if I'm getting praise from Ayatollah Khomeini, you know what he did to the women of Iran just a couple of years ago, and what he does to his own people, and the thousands have been tortured and killed. So if Hitler is thanking me, essentially, I might want to reconsider my position. Yeah? All right. So where does Lot go? He looks around, he sees, oh my gosh, the coolest place in all of Israel to live is called the Kikar HaYarden, this area by the Dead Sea, the Yam HaMelech. And it's very rich with minerals. I don't think it was quite as rich until after the events coming up. But at that time, it was still a very powerful, great property values there. And that's where Sodom and Gomorrah were. Now, everyone knew at that time. It was a davar yadua. It was a known thing that the citizens of Sodom and Gomorrah were evil beyond words. But they were rich. And do you know what the best part of living in Sodom and Gomorrah was? Nobody would worry about whether he muzzles his sheep. The fact that he comes with all the wealth, Sodom and Gomorrah, not only did they not want to share the profits with the poor to show any kindness at all, it was against the rules and the law, subject to the death penalty, yeah, for a Sodomite or a Gomorrahite. I don't know if that's a real word. But you can't even host anybody for a meal. As you know in the story in the Bible, in the Torah, you can get killed. You can get raped and pillaged just for that one crime. So what better place where not only are they not going to look askance at Lot for his decision to leave Abraham and Sarah, they're going to know why he left Abraham and Sarah. Because they're going to say, well, you didn't want to share it with anyone. You want what's yours is yours. And what is someone else is also yours. That was kind of like Sodom, right? So what happens? He goes to live in Sodom. Now, I just want you to just stop for one moment. Can you imagine? Because I can't. The hurt, the pain, the devastation that Abraham and Sarah must have felt at this moment. It's incalculable. I dare say that the departure of Lot almost put back Abraham and Sarah's whole mission in this world by years and years and years. Because if your own nephew, your own brother, can't exist with this sort of fledgling new monotheistic belief, Abraham and Sarah, that you're purveying to the world. If your own guy, right, your own kid, the rabbi's own son, goes off the derech, goes and departs. And not only does he departs in the most egregious, sinful way possible to go to the one place that even the lowlifes of Canaan know that, oh my gosh, we don't mess with Sodom and Gomorrah. No, that's where he goes. So you talk about a betrayal of the most egregious form. So he goes and lives in Sodom and Gomorrah. Why does he go? Because again, he feels that there's no place for him in the world of Abraham. So that's the kindness, shall we say, slippery slope. It's the double-edged sword. You can sometimes be so kind to somebody, and you can do this with absolute well-meaning and with a beautiful heart. But if you're not careful, the receiver of your gift could perceive the gift in the most nefarious way possible. So again, did Abraham and Sarah do anything wrong? Absolutely not. This is all on Lot, his stupidity, his idiocy, and his sinfulness. He lusted after certain things that he couldn't get with Abraham. There's a guilt, that you know, the Jewish guilt thing. Maybe it started right here. And he came up with a defense of his position, right? But be that as it may, it was hurtful to Abraham and Sarah. And Lot, and here's the stunning thing, he never, ever came back home. Never. Even when one Parsha, one the next Torah reading, you come to Vayera, and we have the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham prays to God. Remember, he's haggling with God. If we can only find 50, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10 righteous people in the whole city of Sodom, will you spare them? And God says, yeah, good luck finding the 10. But they didn't find the 10. And you know the story of how the angels literally come to save and pull out Lot. Because of Abraham, they save Lot. And Lot knows this. He knows it's not his righteousness that brings the angels to create a miracle, and they pull him out. He and his two daughters and his wife. You know that the wife looks around and you have the pillar of salt. She doesn't make it out. But you have the three of them surviving. Lot and his two unmarried daughters. Everyone else dies, is immolated. Isn't that kind of crazy that Lot's father is immolated and then everyone else gets immolated? He should have woken up at this point. But here's the most mind-bending thing. They want to take him, essentially, to Abraham and Sarah. And guess what Lot says at this point? He says, Hahara Nasu. Let's go, the angels say, to the mountain. And the rabbis say, who is the mountain that they're referring to? Abraham. We want to take you home to your uncle, to your sister Sarah. And you know what? You know what Lot says? No, I can't go. Kill me. Don't save me. But I'm not going back to Abraham. I can't. Can't return. And again, this is another class, but it's painful to even hear the idea that in the moment of this salvation, right, you're like, I guess it was it Henny Youngman or Jack Benny, right? Your money or your life? And you're thinking,
he's thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. So at that moment, one would think that there would be gratitude. But such was the enormity of the pain from the perspective of Lot, he can't go back to Abraham. So kill me, I'll die, but I can't go back and be Robin again. I can't wear that dumb costume. I want to be Batman in the black. I want to be Abraham or Sarah. Again, I'm just being silly, just to get a little levities in order, because we're doing some very tough concepts here. Okay, so what happens to Lot? We know that he fathers a couple of children with his daughters because they are under the belief, the mistaken belief, that the world is now destroyed. They don't understand that God has only destroyed the Kikar HaYarden, the area around the Dead Sea. I don't know if the Dead Sea was called the Dead Sea before, but now it was definitely the Dead Sea. So the ash, the fire came and destroyed the cities. So they believe that there's only one man in the world who could father a child for the world. So just as Adam and Eve's children could marry, I know it's going to be a little icky here, but potentially they could marry their own sisters because genetics wasn't a problem back then. And who else are they supposed to marry? There aren't any other human beings in the world to marry except for someone who's a close blood relative. So the laws, the rules of the norms of what we do were taken away because you need to do a pruravu, populate the world. Right? So that's what happened. And they gave two children to Lot. And one of them was named Moav. So you might say, well, wow, wait a minute. That has something to do with the book of Ruth. So the story I just shared with you is, ready? It is the origin story of Ruth. What do I mean? Ruth is a Moabitess. It's not just that she's a Moabitess. She is Malchut. She's from the kings of Moab. Her very corpulent, schlubby father or grandfather was none other than Eglon, the king of Moab. Amazing. Now, just as a side point, which is delicious, why does Eglon, the Moabite 700-pound king, why does he get Ruth? Now, because if he gets Ruth, what else descends from Eglon? If you look paternally and the Messiah, Mashiach, King David, King Solomon, they all come from Eglon, this big, fat, vicious.
From Lot.
Right. They all come from Lot and from Eglon. So it's crazy. So you know what the rabbis say? This is why Eglon gets everything good. You know why? Because when Ehud comes to kill him, he has a sword hidden, and I guess he was a lefty, and he hid the knife under his left, so the bodyguards, these, you know, the Secret Service guys who were guarding Eglon, they didn't search him properly. He had the knife stashed away. But before he kills the king says, "What do you want?" And Ehud says, "I come to you with a message from God. Basically, I'm going to kill you because you're a vicious, wicked man." So when Eglon hears the name of God, you know what he does? He stands up off his throne. Now you might say, come on. That's okay. First of all, he was so big and so fat that getting up off that throne was not an easy task for him. And he did it to honor the name of God, of Hashem. So you know what God says up in heaven? You big schlub. Okay. You're still going to die in the next couple seconds. Yeah? But you honored me by getting up off your throne. I'm going to get up off my throne, metaphorically speaking, kibiyakol, and allow your children one day to sit on my throne as the kings of Israel. Wow. I mean, that's kind of cool, right? I mean, that's like a little side note to the history here. So Moav comes from Lot, then you have this Eglon, and then you have Ruth. So our Ruth, who returns to the Jewish people, is not just returning for herself. She's returning as the emissary of her great-great-grandfather, the one who would never go back to Abraham and Sarah, Lot. So Lot does go back, but not in the way that you think. She returns magically. And not only that, but she says to Naomi on her return, remember what Naomi says in the first chapter? She says, you know, you can't come with me, sweetheart. There's nothing for you in the land of Israel. We were in Moab, where you were a princess, where you have lots of money and nobility. Go back home, sweetheart. I love you, but you can't come, Naomi says. And what were the words of Ruth in chapter 1? Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. And look at the last thing. And more also, if anything but death part you and me. You know what the word for parting is in Hebrew? Preda. To depart from somebody. So she says, that will be the only thing, Ruth says to Naomi, that will separate you and me in this world or in the next, death itself. When Abraham says to Lot, he parade na me'alai, uses the same word. And he says, if you won't muzzle your animals, Lot, I love you. I want you to be with me. But you can't be with me when you are committing a desecration of God's name publicly by allowing your animals to steal the food. So he parade na me'alai, please separate yourself from me now. Go right, go left, whatever, right? What should have been Lot's response at that moment? I'm not leaving you. If it means that I have to change my ways and behave better, I'm in. I love you, Abraham. I love Sarah. I'm not leaving you for anything. He doesn't say that, does he? He says, bye. I'm going to Sodom and Gomorrah, never to return again. Even on the point of death, I ain't coming home. And what does Ruth say? The opposite. Naomi says, I have nothing to give you. The opposite of Abraham and Sarah when they speak to Lot. And what is her response? Only death will separate me from you. So the circle that was opened and never closed in the time of Lot and Abraham is closed here with Naomi, grandchild of Abraham, and Ruth, grandchild of Lot. The circle is closed. Beautiful, right? Okay. Kindness. So we touched on the vantage point, the point of view of the warped Lot, that he saw Abraham's kindness and Sarah's kindness as not allowing him, Lot, a place to make a meaningful statement of individuality and independence on his own. That seems to be the issue. What if I told you that that same issue is clear and absolutely unambiguously brought out in the second chapter of the book of Ruth? Because it has to be. In other words, yes, Naomi and Ruth have a relationship, and she says, only death will make me leave you. But what about the moment where she meets the man who will give her a child that will give the Jewish people and the world King David, King Solomon, and the Mashiach and the Messiah? Where was that moment? It's in the second chapter. Here's the moment. You ready? The richest man in all of Israel is Boaz, the head judge, the greatest rabbi and the wealthiest man. And Ruth and Naomi come home, and it's just as Naomi had told Ruth, there's nothing for them. Nobody's delivered. I mean, can you imagine how depraved the area of Israel where they went back to, Beit Lechem Yehuda, was? Naomi has nothing, okay? When a stranger comes to town, you know what Jewish people normally, even what non-Jewish people, just human beings do? Care packages show up at your door. People knock on your door and say, hey, I made Shabbos for you. Here's a little chalent. Here's a little chicken and a piece of kugel. Enjoy Shabbos. Here's a challah. Someone else comes by. What do you need? That's the human response to someone. That's called kindness. It's not even kindness. It's just basic humanity, right? So they're there, Naomi and Ruth, in this place called Bethlehem of Judah. No one's knocking at their door and offering them food. Nobody cares. Drop dead, old lady. We don't care about you. Wow. I mean, it's horrific, right? So because of this, Naomi says, look, I'm an old lady, and I can't go out and glean food from the crops because the barley harvest was coming in, and there's a rule that the landowner has to leave certain parts of his harvest untouched for the poor to come and take for themselves. Leket, shicho, peya, special little gifts. So what happens? So what happens is Ruth has to go out, but she's like a lost little girl. She's like, I don't know if it was a, which fairy tale did the little girl put down the pieces of breadcrumbs? Was it Hansel and Gretel?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So she's kind of like Hansel and Gretel, the Medrash says. She's sort of putting down markers because she's in an alien society. She can't speak the language because she's a Moabitess. And if people find out that she's a Moabitess, people hate Moabitesses and they won't even talk to her. So she has no real way of getting home. She's lost. And yet she has to go out to get food, or she and Naomi are going to starve. So she goes out, and it's just coincidentally, it uses that word. Of course, we know it's God's divine intervention. Of all the fields that Ruth could have gone to glean, to get some food for her and Naomi to eat, what field do you think she goes to? Boaz one of his fields that he owns. And Boaz was not someone who was normally there supervising his field. In fact, he just got up that day from his Shiva, from his 7 days of mourning for his wife that he had buried and lost. So coincidentally, or obviously God's divine orchestration, he shows up in the field. And he's there, and he looks out in the field, and he sees this gorgeous, beautiful young lady, and he knows exactly who she is, by the way. And she's the only one who is going out of her way to be a tsanua, to be modest. She's so beautiful that the guys would lose their mind seeing her. That's how much her beauty was impactful on other people, the men. Okay? So she's, you know, take your the greatest Rita Hayworth or whatever, the most beautiful women you can imagine, and she was 10 times beyond that. But she was also mindful of her own need as a beautiful feminine lady to not excite the men and to not show off her beauty. So she, when she leaned down on the ground to glean, she made sure all of her body was not exposed. She didn't, like, you know, bend over in a lascivious way. She was very mindful to be at Sanua, which, of course, caught the eye of the greatest rabbi. I mean, can you imagine, you know, a rabbi going and saying, "Who's the girl?" Now, I guess that the rabbi just lost a wife and he's okay, he's on the market. I guess it's okay, but it is kind of strange. Okay, so he asks his foreman about her, and his foreman doesn't have any nice things to say about Ruth. Thinking, the foreman, that the big boss, Boaz, doesn't really know. He knows everything about her. He's heard the stories. He knows that his own Enoch, his own Naomi, who's part of Boaz's family, has come back. He's heard the whole stories of how Ruth clung to Naomi and refused to leave her and nobly came all the way back to an uncertain, very shaky future here in the promised land of Israel. Boaz is intimately knowledgeable. Now remember, he was powerless to do anything to help them up to this moment because he was busy mourning his wife, so he couldn't get engaged. This is the first day of his re-engagement in the real world. Now he can try to help. So he knows all about it. So when the foreman sort of says things disparagingly, he basically blows up the foreman. He embarrasses the guy and says, "Shut up. Don't speak like this." And the foreman, as he's talking, he sees Boaz's face, like, you know, with the Darth Vader look, and he starts to get discombobulated. And it's funny because in the text, he just starts to prattle on nonsense because I think he realizes, "Oh, I was speaking disparagingly about Ruth. I probably just lost my job. Lost the gig, you know?" He wasn't a nice guy, whoever that foreman was. Okay, be that as it may, we have the meeting, Boaz and Ruth, for their first time in the field there, okay? And Boaz tries to be very Abraham and Sarah-like. And he says, "Look, you came upon this field. I get this. But you're with me now. I'll take care of you. I'm part of Naomi's family. I'm going to look after you all. So not only, please do me the following favor and not go anywhere else, just come back to this field, but I'm going to give you additionally things to take care of you. So for example, I will give my men an order not to harass you. You can come as many times as you want. The fridge where we keep the sodas is open for you. If you want to grab an extra drink, nobody will look at you funny. And you'll come, you'll have meal with us, you'll join us. Everything will be great. Everything will be wonderful." So you would think, wow, remarkable. What a great offer. Now, what do you think Ruth, granddaughter of Lot, the suspicious one of Abraham and Sarah's kindness, the chesed, the kindness of strangers, how is she as a Moabitess going to react to this offer from Boaz? You want to guess? She's going to say, "I don't know." She's not going to willingly say, "Oh, I love it." Why would she not say, "I willingly take it"? Because she is a Moabitess. It's not their nature. Moabites don't share. You might say, "Rabbi, where do you get this from?" It's in the Torah. Even 10 generations removed, if a Moabite chooses to become Jewish and converts to Judaism in a righteous convert, they may marry another convert and the other people, but a Moabite can't marry a Jew. even 10 generations removed. You know why? Because when we, the Jewish people, were coming into the promised land of Israel, and we went through the territories adjacent to where Moab and Ammon lived, we wanted to buy some food and drink. Buy food and drink, not to ask for a gift. And you know what the Moabites and Ammonites said to us? Walk on, we're not giving you anything. Because it's antithetical to their nature as a Moab to share. Where do you think they get that defective gene from? Sodom, Gomorrah, and Lot, clearly. So there's a defective gene there. So Ruth is not that. She's an amazing person. But there's still part of her that is the Lot part of her. So let's go back now. Remember, the criticism in the mind of Lot of Abraham and Sarah's kindness was not real. It was fake. But it was real to Lot. He perceived that all the great kindness that Abraham and Sarah did not allow him, Lot, a place in this world. He was always the gam lelot. It's always the adjunct guy. I'm never the superstar. I will always be the secondary character to the play of Abraham and Sarah. There's no room for me. That's not real from the position of Abraham and Sarah, but it was real in the mind of Lot. So that's real in the mind of Ruth. So even though Boaz gives her this amazing offer, I mean, think about her. She is desperate beyond words. She's literally gleaning in a field, and she doesn't even know how to get home to bring the gleanings back to Naomi. She's worried, I don't even know, I can't even ask anybody for directions. Nobody will even talk to me. They'll spit at me because I'm a Moabitess. I have nothing. And yet she's still concerned about what? Her own identity, and not allowing this very generous rabbi, Boaz, to take from her the one thing that she can't give up, which is herself. So what does Boaz respond? He responds magnificently. Because remember, Boaz is representing Abraham and Sarah. So now he tells the truth of Abraham and Sarah's kindness, how we do kindness for strangers. So what does he say to her? God forbid that this is a unilateral gift. This is mutuality, sweetheart. I have heard already about what you did for my kinspeople, how you came with Naomi in her greatest time of need, how you relinquish your own inheritance that you were rightfully allowed to take from Naomi's house because you were married to Mahlon, her dead son. So you had the rights to get money and you gave it all up because you love Naomi. You didn't want that. And I heard about how you heroically stuck by Naomi in thick and thin and came back to her, knowing you're coming to an alien land where they won't even talk to you, this Beit Lechem Yehuda place where people are, even my people, Boaz admits, they're right now derelict in their ability to even help you. They're not even willing to come by, like we said, and give you Shabbos food or anything. They don't care about you or Naomi. And I get it, but the fact that you left your father and mother's house to come here. And it's amazing because Shmuel HaNavi, when Samuel writes these words, the words echo the first words we're given when we meet Abraham. Lech lecha me'artzecha me'bladecha me'beis avicha. How you left and went from your household and your father's house to come to this strange land. The exact same words as Abraham is described way back in Genesis and Bereshit. They're used by Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel, to show the perspective of how much Boaz appreciates and honors Ruth. So he says to her, you know what, my dear? What am I giving you? Some food? I got a lot of money, got a lot of food. But you know what? This is not a one-way street, my dear. This is mutual. You have already inspired me to remember what it means to be a Jew, to be a human being, because this is a place bereft of kindness. And because of your kindness that you did for Naomi and for my family, you reopened my eyes and the eyes of everyone who hears your magical story. We now see you as a modern day representation of Abraham and Sarah. So please accept whatever I'm going to do for you, but know that this is a mutual relationship because you've already given me a million times more of the value of your inspiration. You've reawakened within me and with all the people who meet you what it means to be a human being and a Jew through kindness. So please, it would be so meaningful to me if you would just accept my little meaningless gift, very little that I'm giving you. Oh, and Ruth says, if that's the case, that this is mutual, that I've already given you, and you're just giving me a little bit, I kindly accept. Wow. This is the kindness of strangers. This is the tikkun. This moment repairs the loss of Lot, where Lot had an inability to see the true nature of Abraham and Sarah's grace and kindness that they did for the world. And therefore he left never to return. But his great-granddaughter, Ruth, returns. And Ruth's a little skeptical. She has to put it into words up front with Boaz, great-grandchild of Sarah and Abraham. She has to understand, as a Moabite, is where is this coming from? And as long as it's coming from a place that allows otherness and independence to the one receiving the gift, I'm in with you. As long as we're here together, I'm in. And this, of course, echoes Mount Sinai and that mutual relationship that we have with Hashem, with God. So in other words, Ruth allows us to see ourselves at Mount Sinai and our relationship with God. So to end, when one does a kindness for somebody else, you're actually doing a kindness ultimately for yourself. The rabbis, based on this little area here with Boaz and Ruth, you know what they say? Yoser mimashal b'bayis osala ani ani osal b'bayis. More than what the homeowner gives to the poor person by giving them a little food for Shabbos and hosting them, the homeowner receives much more in return for the kindness that he or she gives. What does that mean? What does kindness cost you? A smile? A couple bucks here or there? Opening your heart a little bit? Mazel tov. What do you get back from that act? Eternity. Whereas one action of kindness is a temporary physical action in this realm, the physical realm, the one who does that action. In other words, think about it. If it was a Lot that you were dealing with who said, no, I will not accept your kindness, where would that leave you? You don't get an opportunity in eternity. So the very fact that you need the other person to be willing, like Ruth was only when she understood the depths of the relationship with Boaz, then and only then would she accept and acquiesce. We need the poor person, or the person, don't even call him poor person, the person who is in need to not only have that need, but be willing to accept your offer. Otherwise, you don't get the eternity. So it is a beautifully symbiotic mutual relationship. We should always keep that in mind when we have our relationships and in the merit of Ruth and of Boaz and their unique, beautiful understanding of the true nature of the kindness of strangers. Thank you.